Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we invite our leading historians to go fully automatic. The podcast where myth and misconception gets a precise three rounds in the centre mass. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and riding shotgun with me today is my loyal co-host, the butch to my Sundance, Kyle Glover.
Hello everyone. I think I'd be more of a Doc Holliday type character, but do go on.
Come down with tuberculosis or something.
Yes.
Anyway, yes. We're your huckleberries this week. So this week, loyal listeners, we are joined from across the water by firearms historian, consultant, and executive director of the University of Wyoming's Firearms Research Center. Am I pronouncing that right for you?
You did.
And this is Ashley Chlebinski. Ashley, welcome to History Rage.
Thank you. And I have to say that I was very impressed by all the gun pun references in your introduction. It was very well done.
Who doesn't like a pun?
Very subtle, wasn't it?
You certainly love them, yeah. So you've come to us by recommendation from the other major firearms historian that we had on, Jonathan Ferguson, when he came on to Rage about the Bren and MG42 argument. But before we dive into tonight's subject, can you tell us a bit about your background, your work, and how you landed in this particular field?
Sure. So my pathway to studying firearms, I always say, is kind of a circuitous route. Yes, I am from America, but no, I did not grow up around guns at all. The first time I ever, held a gun, really probably even saw one in real life, was when I was 18 at my first museum internship. So I didn't grow up in that culture. So I came into the study of it, a little bit naive, which I kind of liked because it meant I didn't come in with all the political baggage, that you get with firearms in American culture today. And so I actually got interested through historic ballistics, and historic ballistics being a very, very wide lens. But I wanted to be a doctor my whole life. I had a lot of medical problems growing up. And so I was convinced going into college that I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. And then within my first semester, I changed my major to history.
Because that's a leap. It's a leap.
I know, it's terrible. My mom, I always use her and she hates that I say this, but when I changed my major, my mom said, and I quote, "You better have a fucking job when you graduate." Because history majors don't always have that. So I had to think quickly on my area of study, but I got interested through kind of the evolution of battlefield medicine. So I went on a tour in Gettysburg with the American Civil War, and they talked about how basically the advancements of weapons technology and with that particular war, ammunition technology really changed. And so how that the change in shape of projectile impacted the type of injury you had on the battlefield and therefore impacted how doctors and medical professionals had to deal with it. And it's actually kind of interesting because in the American Revolution, you have a round musket ball. By the Civil War, you've got a conically shaped projectile. And so you actually see more amputations in the Civil War because that's more likely to shatter the bone. So basically, I'm just really fucked up in the head, and this is how I got into guns. But so basically, you had more, you know, the bone was more likely to shatter. So then, even though medicine was more advanced, they still couldn't do very much. You had a better chance, not a great chance, but a better chance with a round musket ball. So I got interested through that, and I started studying guns specifically, and mostly military guns. And then I got my first internship, which was at a military museum right from where I'm from, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I essentially, you know, went in there totally blind, and I was handed this like firearms collection that was mainly Civil War, but it did go up through more modern conflicts. And they were like, all right, catalog this, you know, what is it? What have been modified on each of the guns? And that was the first time I ever actually encountered a gun in the real world. And so I had to learn pretty quickly what they were, how they operated. And then after that internship, I learned how to shoot modern guns, historic guns. I've actually shot a replica hand cannon, which is the oldest firearm in existence, all the way up through modern machine guns. Ended up at the Smithsonian's National Firearms Collection while I was in school, and then went to grad school studying firearms, specifically armed feminism and leftist firearms activism in the 60s and 70s. And then there's a very large museum out in Wyoming called the Cody Firearms Museum. We do a lot of work with the Royal Armories as well. And that's affiliated with the Smithsonian. So I started working between the two organizations. And when I graduated from grad school, I went out there full time, which I don't know how much everybody knows about, you know, the United States, but I basically moved from like a city East Coast hub to the middle of nowhere, Wyoming. So it was quite the culture shock for me. But then I was there for 10 years and I started working with other museums as a consultant. And now here I am with you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peak of your career. Yeah. So, well, thank you very much. That is quite the whirlwind career.
Yeah,
I still can't get over that massive jump from like medicine to firearms history. Though,
you know, I did an interview years ago with Ted Koppel, and like before we were doing the interview, it was just kind of a nice dialogue. And he asked me how I got involved in firearms, and you know, he told me about his, you know, one firearm story, which is always how somebody that doesn't really work with firearms, they always have to tell you about like the one gun they encountered or that they shot. But so we had this great dialogue. It was really wonderful. And then the cameras start rolling and he asks me the same question. I'm like, well, you know, I wanted to be a doctor. And he interrupts me and he goes, so you went from wanting to save lives to things that take them. And I was like, shit, this interview is not going the way I thought it was going to go. So that's the very, you know, dramatic transition in my career.
Well, let's kick into tonight's rage. So, Ashley, with all the emotion that you feel it warrants, will you please tell our parade ground of history ragers out there what you wish everyone would just stop believing?
Okay, so you said with as much rage, so now I'm just going to disappoint you. But basically that historically speaking, gun owners haven't just been old white guys.
Okay.
That was not ragey.
Okay. But expand a little.
Okay. So, you know, obviously when you think about your typical American gun owner, I think people think, you know, older, white, conservative.
We think Charlton Heston over here. That's who we think, you know.
Oh, that's who you think? All right. So Charlton Heston is your kind of, you know, model. And in America, a lot of people associate just, you know, old white guys as your gun people. And I will say that there is some truth to that for sure, as I'm not an old white guy in the field and I can be quite an anomaly, at least in the historical field with firearms. But when you talk about more modern day, there's actually a whole conversation and dialogue about the diversification of firearms ownership. And they talk about, you know, oh, there's so many more women carrying firearms today than there were in the past. You know, the African-American gun ownership is up. Asian-American gun ownership is up. And so there's all these kind of conversations, but they couch it in this idea that this is new, that, you know, people like that, people like me, we didn't own firearms historically. And that's just not true. And so I've done a lot of research, you know, going all the way back with firearms history, to show that women were a huge part of that story, but then also, especially in American culture, African-Americans, Black Americans were a huge part of that story leading up and right after the Civil War. And so I've just been kind of like over the years trying to dispel that. Even gun people are like, you know, they call it this new phenomenon because it sounds good. You know, it's a cool marketing term for today. Like, look at all these new gun owners. But they don't even realize that gun owners are have been diverse for a really long time.
So historically speaking, and we're going sort of right back in time here, possibly even pre-America.
How dare you?
But who, I know, me British and thinking that there might be a time, you know. Well, I like to cut 1776 out of the picture and ignore it. But so historically speaking, who has traditionally owned firearms?
So the earliest types of gun owners overseas in Europe, obviously that's the beginning of it, were people who were interested in kind of firearms for sport and defense. So sports target shooting, the earliest target shooting competitions date to 1475. So you're talking about a lot of different reasons why people are using firearms even back then. And kind of from the start, you see men and women owning firearms. There's actually, most early firearms are kind of custom orders from gun makers or multiple gun making guilds. And so you're able to kind of identify who owned the firearm a lot better or what type of person would own the firearm a lot easier. And so there were firearms that we've got surviving examples being made during that time frame that were for men, for women. And that was pretty common. And by the 1600s, you actually start getting your kind of major collector. You know, this isn't initially, yeah, it's kind of a collecting is kind of a thing of the aristocracy of royalty. But quickly, you know, the more, well, it's not really middle class by then. You could tell my like lack of knowledge of not American history. But by the 1600s, the emerging middle class really starts owning firearms a lot as well.
Yeah. Are there any female historical figures that we'd be surprised to learn that they owned and used firearms?
So I think my favorite example of a female owning firearms, a woman owning firearms dating kind of way, way back is Catherine the Great, the Empress of Russia. And see, there's been a lot of kind of publicity around her recently because there's a fantastic, completely historically inaccurate version of her life on Hulu that doesn't really, there's some gun stuff in there, but they don't really touch on that. But she was actually an avid hunter. Is it huntress? I don't know.
You can identify as what you wish these days, you know.
Okay, we'll say hunter. And there's a lot of surviving firearms that belong to her. So I worked at the Smithsonian Collection, and they have, I think, two of her firearms that she used for hunting. And the one's great because it's got this piece of velvet right on the stock so that her royal skin would not touch the wood of a stock, which is kind of funny because she loved wood. She's one of my favorite kind of people, not just for her gun ownership, because she's one of those people that kind of busted all stereotypes with women at that time frame. I mean, if you're not familiar with her story, she was not from Russia, goes to Russia to marry the future leader of Russia, and then overthrows him within like the first year of his reign. And so she becomes beloved, even though she's not Russian. But she also is like known for all of her kind of illicit affairs. And she involves guns in those as well, I guess. Well, okay, maybe now I'm making a conspiracy. But so there was a gun in the Cody Firearms Museum collection that Catherine the Great gave to King Louis, can't remember which one, of France. And it was supposed to be, you know, because of a peace treaty that they had done. But I personally tend to think it might have had more to do with, you know, a little something else she had going on the side. I'm just spreading all kinds of rumors about her, but she can't fight back, so I don't care.
Have we got any other kind of leading pre-American women that you can identify as, you know, being gun nuts, gun collectors?
Specific women, not necessarily, but you can see in all different parts of Europe that there are firearms that have survived that belong to women. They were made and commissioned by women. And so you kind of see that across the board, which I think is important to this distinction of women not, or gun owners not just being old fucking white guys. And that's because average normal women were owning firearms. It was completely typical in England, overseas in Europe, and, you know, all the way over to Russia. And so the fact that, you know, you've got people who are normal owning firearms that aren't just men is pretty extraordinary, dating all the way back to that time frame.
Mm. One of the things that struck me is when I went on honeymoon, we went to New York, which was wonderful, and we also went to San Francisco, which was awful. But we sorry to everybody in San Francisco, but it wasn't fun. But I did stumble across there are two dueling pistols in the Met Museum of Art, and they were part of a collection of firearms as actual art, which interested me.
Oh, that's actually, so that's really, I feel like this is a little bit of a tangent, but that's an interesting thing because most arms collections, and I say arms because I'm trying to include, you know, swords and earlier edged weapons, crossbows, longbows, because a lot of the art museums go kind of that far back in their collections, and a lot of European museums as well. I mean, you don't really get all the more modern guns in European collections. So arms, we're just going to say arms. But a lot of those actually started, all of those collections started in art museums and people that were art collectors. And in fact, in Europe, by the 1600s, in a lot of cases, a gun maker was paid more than a traditional artist because people saw firearms as a decorative art. So you can have a firearm that's, you know, complete art that you're never going to do anything with, like Catherine the Great's, you know, presentation piece to King Louis of France. So you got stuff like that where you're going to hang it on the wall. You're never going to use it. It's gorgeous. It's embellished. You know, it's got all of this like wire inlay, you know, stones, you know, precious stones on the guns. But then there is that practical side of it. So even really nice looking firearms end up being used for hunting. In fact, if you look at hunting guns, especially from, you know, the 1600s, earlier and after, you see that there's a ton of, you know, intricate embellishment, and even hunting guns today have significant engraving. So those collections were considered art so much that the earliest guns and some of the earliest gun collections that end up in museums, particularly in America, appear in art museums, which is kind of funny because I think people who study art would probably be incredibly offended to have their work compared to firearms.
Yeah. So to flash forward to in both in time and location to the early Americas, who owned firearms there and specifically why? What were they using them for?
So now I'm going to like contradict myself a little bit because there were a lot of old white guys, or like, it's not old, but white guys owning firearms in the colonies. And the reason for that were because there were a lot of firearms laws that specifically said that free blacks, enslaved persons, mulattoes is a term they use, and Native Americans couldn't legally own firearms in certain colonies. But women were a huge kind of group of firearms owners during that time frame. And there's actually, there's inventories that are done in individual colonies of the kind of all of the different firearms and artillery that are personally owned by people, because yes, cannons did belong to civilians in the colonies leading up to the revolution.
I'm sorry, just backtrack a little there. I mean, you know, I can have an opinion on American gun culture, but owning cannons?
They own cannons. I mean, why not, I guess? You know, but there's a blurring of kind of the line of civilian and soldier, especially in early America. And so, you know, you got to have everything. And actually, civilians ended up having far superior firearms a lot of the time because they could have an individually made rifle, whereas your soldiers are carrying a smoothbore musket. And so it's kind of this interesting thing. But these inventories, I think, is very kind of progressive for the time, would delineate male and female gun ownership and kind of acknowledge the number of men, number of women in the colony, the number of, and it would be broken down to, you know, handguns. It'd be broken down to muskets, rifles, fowling pieces, so shotguns, and cannons. And so I always thought that was kind of interesting to see that they were even considering that back then. And even though there were laws limiting, you know, any type of person of color from owning firearms, it's not that it didn't happen. Because, you know, the Americans, in a lot of respects, they, depending on who they were talking to, the British and as well the French would arm Native Americans for military purposes. So it's not like they never got access to them. It was just they put these laws in place to try to limit their ownership because of fear of, you know, obviously death of the old white guys that owned firearms. And so they were trying to, it was very racist. They were trying to keep firearms out of the hands of people that weren't them. But it doesn't mean that they didn't have them.
Yeah. And I suppose if you're going over and colonizing a country, the last thing you want is that country to be even more armed than you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know.
Well, and the other thing, too, is, I mean, they were so serious about it that, like, a lot of the laws in the colonies that said you couldn't own them if you were a person of color, those laws also said you couldn't sell to people of color. And so, and those things were punishable by death in a lot of cases. So they were not messing around when it came to those laws.
Okay, so let's go a little bit further into the American then, my little obsession. So the American West, there are a stack load of iconic women that were known for firearms ownership. You've got your Annie Oakleys, your Lillian Smiths, your Calamity Janes. Why do you think their stories are so interesting to people now if female gun ownership isn't a thing?
Well, that's an interesting question. It jumps a little bit forward in history because there's a lot that goes on in the American South that deals with kind of diversification and gun ownership around the same time. I mean, the Western progression is, you know, starts early. And with the earliest kind of settlers going out into the American West pre-American Civil War, you do get a lot of women that are going out there, either on their own or with a family. And then in a lot of cases, you know, a lot of people didn't survive going out West, especially in the earliest kind of time frame. And if you've ever played the Oregon Trail game,
I haven't.
I don't know. We had it when I was a kid. Oh man, it was so good. But a lot of people die. A lot of people die of dysentery. And so a lot of times, even if a woman went out with, you know, a family with a husband, they were often widowed out there. And so you had kind of a lot of women that had to carry guns, had to arm themselves in order to protect themselves, because the American West was certainly, not the safest area for a whole host of reasons. But it's kind of interesting in terms of women, once you get to the latter part of the 19th century, so after the American Civil War, when the, you know, prominence of the West, the Wild West, the Western myth and the Western pop culture really kind of appears. And so you've got the foundation being laid of women going out there, but then there's this whole kind of creation of, you know, the American lifestyle, quote unquote, which is, you know, the Wild West, the cowboy, the people who are out there. And women played a very prominent role in that. So then they play a prominent role in the pop culture. And you know, you mentioned Annie Oakley, but you also mentioned Lillian Smith. And I feel like that's because I mentioned her name, but maybe you knew who she was, but a lot of people don't recognize her name.
I actually did, everybody out there who doesn't. Yeah.
A lot of people don't. And that I've actually written about a lot, about kind of the cool girl or the girl that doesn't fit the kind of mold of the perfect, you know, wholesome American woman, doesn't necessarily survive in history, in terms of historical memory. And so Lillian Smith is one, because she and Annie Oakley absolutely fucking hated each other. And Lillian Smith was like, you know, she was brash. She swore a lot. She was sleeping around on her husband. She had, you probably know Lillian Smith because of her trip to Wimbledon, which marked kind of the end of her career.
Wimbledon will end anybody's career.
Well, it really was the first time that she started going into obscurity, because everybody loved her. They were like, oh my God, look at her. She swears. She's so edgy. But then she really kind of sucked when she went over in England. And there was this other story where she met the Queen, and so did Annie Oakley. And she shook the Queen's hand. Am I remembering that story correctly? And people were fine with her interactions with the Queen, but Annie Oakley did the exact same thing and got, you know, basically, you know, obliterated in the media. How could you do that? Because Lillian was given grace, because that was Lillian. But then she sucked in Wimbledon, and everyone started saying, well, she's faking, you know, her trick shots. She's not that good. God, she's annoying. And then she basically kind of, she sets world records for the rest of her life, but nobody talks about her anymore. And everybody remembers Annie Oakley. Like, I mean, you don't even have to like guns or be an American to know who Annie Oakley is.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So you mentioned a few things that are going on in the South before the progression west, though. Do you like to kind of expand on those a little?
Sure. So I mentioned the colonies. I mentioned the laws that were put in place to keep people of color from owning firearms. And that obviously continues in the Civil War, in the pre-Civil War South, as slavery is a very kind of important component to plantation ownership. And so those laws kind of continue, and there's some interesting like back and forth that goes on. And every state's different because you don't really get federal firearms laws until 1934. So, you know, it's kind of hard to, there's a lot of cross-pollination in concept, but then every state's different. So it's incredibly confusing. But in the early 1800s, up through the mid 1800s, you'll see laws that'll say, you know, free blacks can't own guns. And then they'll say, oh, no, free blacks can't own guns. And then they'll say, never mind. Like every couple of years, it's a different thing. And usually when the state decides that African-Americans can't own firearms, then they go and they literally raid the houses of free blacks from owning firearms. And so these laws are kind of going back and forth leading into the Civil War. And then directly after the Civil War, there's an important thing that goes on that really impacts African-American gun ownership. And that's male and female, because there's some prominent figures that I'll mention. Mm-hmm. But basically, after the Civil War, there is the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And there's something called the Second Freedmen's Bureau. And then 1868 is the 14th Amendment, which gives African-Americans kind of equal citizenship. Well, equals, wrong term there. Gives them citizenship rights. And so in 1866, now your laws can't say black people can't own guns. Your laws have to be a little bit kind of around, like dance around that. And so the way that those laws kind of came about was they were Army-Navy laws. And so they basically said, okay, everybody can own guns, but you can only own, you know, Colt Army Navies, or you can only own, you know, Army Navies of several models, which happened to be very expensive. And so now it tried to eliminate, you know, gun ownership for an entire class of people. So it wasn't just, you know, free blacks, or I guess they're all free at that point. It's not just African-Americans, but it's, you know, anyone in a poorer class. And so it really affected poor rural communities as well. But during, you know, Reconstruction and during the South becomes a very violent place after the Civil War. I think a lot of people don't realize, you know, things did not really get better for a long time. And things, in fact, you know, got worse with mob rule, which were white mobs down in the South, and the government kind of picking and choosing when they enforce certain things. And so that led to an entire movement of African-Americans recommending and encouraging gun ownership within the black community. And one of the more iconic figures from that time frame is Ida B. Wells. Ida B. Wells was a black journalist from up north, and she decides to go down to the South and start to cover kind of the lynchings and the mobs that were, you know, occurring in that region. And she witnessed several of them. And then she writes this report that goes national about what happened, but then also saying basically that the Winchester rifle should be the pride and joy of every black home in America. And it continues with something to the extent of, like, you know, to protect yourself from something that the government won't do. So basically saying the government's not going to protect you, so you need to protect you. And so firearms and Winchesters play a very big role in the black community, especially in the South, but then also as you start moving westward. And I think Frederick Douglass was a big advocate, you know, and proponent of it. So that's an interesting part of the history where I feel like people don't realize those characters were carrying guns. They had to carry guns. They weren't safe. And Ida B. Wells took it further, and she actually, you know, paid for shooting associations. She did. She created a shooting club up in Chicago to train women, to train black people to arm themselves. And she did that, I think, in a couple of other places in America. So it wasn't just, you know, I'm going to own a gun, but it was also, you know, I'm going to make sure that black Americans can arm themselves because we can't trust our government. And so that is a movement that happens, you know, across the board throughout the East Coast, and then also moving west, because there are also female and African American women associated with firearms out west. One of them named Stagecoach Mary, Mary Fields. She drove a stagecoach out west.
Just brings me a couple of questions there. Now, bear in mind, my understanding of American law is pitiful, to say the least. But you talk there that post-Civil War, that, you know, now African Americans have citizenship, not necessarily as many rights. But, you know, at that point, you have that fundamental Second Amendment of the Constitution that is a constitutional right that all can bear arms. How does that fit in with them trying to dance around what is there a major underpinning part of American law that still affects us today?
So the kind of experimentations with restrictions on firearms ownership actually shifts a little bit in that time frame to carry. So you may be able to own something, but you might not be able to carry it. And concealed carry is the big kind of conversation. So open carry, and that, like, what's interesting is open carry today across the board is something that's a lot less, it's a lot less controlled than concealed carry is in certain states. And that's because back then the concept was, well, if you're open carrying, you're being honest about it, but if you want to conceal it, then you're being shady. And so there were a lot of states that started regulating concealed carry. And with concealed carry, they would list certain types of firearms, and not just firearms, but like different knives, brass knuckles, all kinds of weird shit. Like when you look at the law, there's like 10 different things, and it's the weirdest list of stuff on the planet that you can't carry. But that's kind of where that starts to shift. And what you'll see is, and I mentioned it with kind of the laws that were regulating people, you'll see where they'll get passed and then they'll get repealed as a violation of the Second Amendment. And that's going on in the early 1800s. That's going on after the American Civil War. You'll see a lot of the laws kind of go into effect and then it'll be ruled unconstitutional. And that's not necessarily just federally. Pretty much all the states had their own kind of constitutional right for firearms ownership. And so they were kind of doing it within their own state. But that's where a lot of the dialogue, you know, that even comes about today. Not to get into all that crap, but, you know, the Supreme Court last year ruled that the number one way to determine constitutionality of a firearm law is by looking at the history. And by looking at the history means what they call the most important time frame, founding era. So around the ratification of the Second Amendment in 1791, what was available? What were the laws? Were their laws comparable back then to laws today? And then the second most important time frame is the second founding era, which is around the ratification of the 14th Amendment. What was around? What were the laws? And can they be compared to today? And so all of that kind of laid the foundation and is back and forth with what the laws could and could not do has been going on since, you know, the 1800s and after the Civil War. It's kind of wild when you think about it.
And while we're on the subject of wild, I mean, like, itching to ask this question, and you seem the perfect person to ask. I haven't put it on the list, so I am putting you on the spot here.
Oh, but that's fine. I didn't read the list. No,
but we talk about the Wild West, but really, how wild is it?
Oh God! Oh yeah, you guys wanted to do a whole episode on this. Well, I guess that, you know, really depends on your definition of wild and where you're looking and what time frame. So, I mean, obviously, when you're going out west, in wagons, and there's no, you know, transnational railroad that's going in. I mean, you're going into a completely. It's kind of the same for the colonists, right? The first people that came to America are experiencing, you know, no real creation of any type of society, which I guess you could argue may or may not be a good thing. there's no forged path, so you know you're basically doing it yourself, climbing through mountains, going through inclement weather. You are encountering Native Americans. And that's its own, you know, entire conversation. That's its own rage, I think, is Native American gun ownership. We'll get into that if we want, because that's fascinating, is what the government did to the Native Americans with firearms and firearms ownership is really fucked up. And they're a huge proponent of firearms ownership in the American West. But you get encounters with, you know, and clashes with different people that are going out there and the native populations that are already out there. And then you do go to the creation of these, you know, towns, and you'll actually see gun laws out in those towns. So There are some laws in certain towns that'll say, check your firearms in before you come into the town, because there was a fear that basically cowboys and, you know, people on big cattle drives who now have all kinds of money are going to come into these towns and they're going to start gambling and they're going to like hire hookers and they're going to get wasted and then they're going to shoot each other. And so there's this kind of preemptive strike on that with the actual like laws that they would put in there. But we don't actually know if anybody really followed them. And in a lot of respects, the West isn't nearly as violent as people say it is. I don't study it as much, but I know the current curator of CODI, he used to have the stats on the number of people that were actually, you know, getting killed in the American West in these towns. You know, homicide rates, were completely ignoring, you know, full massacres of people by the Mormons too. The Mormons did some shit in the American West. Did a lot of shit in the American West. But we're, you know, ignoring that. But the actual like person to person homicide rates are not as high as people think they are.
So firearms ownership is often seen as being intertwined with concepts of agency and autonomy and freedom. How did historical contexts such as wartime or living on the frontier influence people's decision to own firearms? You mentioned there's a particular instance such as what was done to the Native Americans and how they viewed firearms ownership.
Yeah. So, you know, agency is a great, you know, conversation about that because, you know, as I've talked a little bit about, you know, a lot of times there's this fight between who can own guns and who can't own guns. And then people saying, fuck it, I'm just going to own them anyways. And if you look at the Civil War South, which I talked about, and how Black Americans are now, you know, carrying firearms because they don't feel safe from their government. And that translates out in the American West as well with Native American gun ownership. So, you've got, you know, the laws in the colonies trying to prevent American Indians from owning firearms. But then you also have, you know, the English, the French, you know, colonists, you know, initially, you know, once you get the United States, you know, Americans, you've got these people saying, no, you can't own guns. But then also we're going to backdoor sell you guns because we want you to fight for us to, you know, help fuck over someone else. So it's this weird, messed up, you know, relationship. So just because the law's there doesn't mean that the U.S. government isn't pumping guns into the hands of the people that they say they also don't want to have guns. And so you get that tradition of gun ownership with Native Americans like immediately. And they do, you know, they do adopt firearms. I know that there's a lot of kind of debate within certain tribal nations about how prevalent gun ownership was. But I mean, it was there. And the flintlock, which was the reigning, you know, ignition system of firearms by the American Revolution, really from like, you know, the 1600s onward until you get the percussion ignition system in the 1800s. But it was such an easy thing for them in terms of operation because it operates with this piece of, you know, sharpened flint. So that's something that, you know, is accessible. It's something that they can sharpen. And the type of projectile everyone was using was, you know, a round musket ball, but, you know, that was, you know, questionable. Like that was an easy thing to kind of get. And so they were using them and they were applying them into hunting. You can actually see artistic depictions from that time frame and after of American Indians using firearms for hunting. So it's not just a defense and military, a self-defense and military thing. It's also a hunting thing. So it's as prevalent, you know, and used for as many different uses as everybody, you know, women and African Americans and you know, old white guys. So they're using them for everything too. What ends up happening though is when you transition into the 1800s, there's this development called the percussion ignition system. And now your firearms are far more advanced, but you have to have these little caps that go on to the firearm in order to fire them. And that was difficult for a lot of Native Americans to access. And so they continue to use older guns, but they still continue to use guns. And then there is a movement with, you know, kind of the frontiersmen. They'll trade firearms. They actually have, you know, varying, you know, relationships with Native Americans. That actually means a lot of different things. But a lot of times, a lot of the frontiersmen did get along with the Native Americans, but obviously not always. So they're owning guns. They're using guns. They're trading with, you know, other Americans. But then it starts to get a little, well, I guess it's always been a little shady with Native Americans, but it gets, you know, we were giving them smallpox blankets and shit. But it gets really, really kind of dark in American history in the American West as you start developing more superior firearms that are popping up in the civilian market. And one of the guns that's most often referenced For this is the Winchester Model 1866 lever action, which they do call the Yellow Boy, which is a Native American designation based on the yellow frame of the gun. And so what happens here is that there's kind of a flip. You've got these repeating firearms. You've got these rapid firing firearms that take a cartridge that's, you know, easy to load, quick to load. And you've got people all over the country owning those, Ida B. Wells, you know, being one of the biggest proponents of them. You've got people all over the country owning them, but the U.S. government is not owning them. They're not employing them. They're still using single shot guns as you get into military conflict in the American West. And so you've got Native Americans who have access to those firearms. And they did. I mean, you have to kind of consider, I mean, Winchesters were expensive. And there were attempts by people selling ammunition to limit their access to the type of ammo because it was very specific ammo at that, you know, at that point. And so there is kind of an interplay in the civilian world to try to prevent them or make it really expensive for them to get guns, but they do have Winchesters. So that's kind of the fateful kind of history that we talk about a lot, which is the Wounded Knee Massacre, which started with gun confiscation of a Native tribe. And so basically the U.S. government came in, tried to take the firearms. There were Winchesters there. They recovered Winchesters. There's a lot of kind of debate about exactly how it all got started, but basically a shot rang out and, you know, basically everyone that was there was slaughtered. And then after that, there is a movement again, kind of going back to the colonies to disarm Native Americans. And so one of the things as we start to force Native Americans, you know, out of their homes and onto reservations, they have to surrender their firearms. And so you see kind of that. And I think that's why a lot of the modern tribal nations argue that they don't necessarily have a gun culture. And that's because, you know, as soon as the reservation system got put into place, they weren't allowed to have them in a lot of places. And so you get this kind of like arc of you can't have them, but we kind of have them. Now we're using better technology and now you can't have it at all. It's really kind of a tragic, you know, part of the story, but it is a fascinating one that I don't think a lot of people know about.
Okay, so to wrap things up then, can you talk a little bit about, you've mentioned that, you know, we've got this demographic of Native Americans, African Americans, women who are all owning guns, whether or not they should be. So clearly there's a market for it there. You know, how is that market behaving? Can you tell us a little bit about American gun advertising in that period and how they catered to those particular audiences?
Well, I would say, based on American gun advertising in the late 19th, turn of the 20th century, I don't think they were really advertising to Native Americans. And I don't think Black Americans, I could be wrong. But women is a specific key demographic, which I think is really interesting. You know, by the late 19th century in America, you're starting to get kind of the modern consumer culture or the early stages of the modern consumer culture start happening in the 1890s and at the turn of the 20th century. So you're seeing advertisements all over the place. Like it's not just gun specific, but there's, you know, these kind of more modern ads. But I think it's fascinating that gun manufacturers recognized all the way back then that women were such a key customer that they needed to market to them. So, you know, it wasn't just like, well, market to your husband and then maybe you'll get a gun. I mean, they were making these ads and they were making guns too. I mean, Smith & Wesson in the early 1900s, like 1901, 1902, had an entire line of Ladysmith revolvers. And there were other companies that were making guns specifically for women. So it went beyond just their marketing. But these ads, you know, kind of took multiple approaches. So you had kind of protective mother figures. So you had women who were protecting their family. And a lot of times, you know, especially into the 20th century with world wars, you do get this kind of advertising of when your husband's away, you know, you have to protect your family. And so you get that. That starts in the 19th century, kind of a dialogue, but certainly, you know, during the First and Second World War, you see that continue. So there's kind of mother protector, but then there's also, there's hunting depictions. So there's woman as hunter. A lot of times, I think my favorite image that I'm thinking of is a Winchester ad, and this lady's in like a yellow, like rain slicker. Slicker, is that the word?
Go with that, yeah.
Raincoat? Did I just make up a word? We're going to go with raincoat. Because I don't know if that was a word. So she's wearing this all yellow top to bottom, and then she's got her hunting dog, and she's got a really fancy, you know, shotgun. And so it's oftentimes, you know, really nice companies that are marketing to women. And then there's also a woman as a target shooter. And as like a way to get men. So there's ads where it's like, you know, all the men want to talk to the ladies who can shoot accurately. And so there's like Smith & Wesson, I think it is, has an ad where you got the target and, you know, she's got a good grouping and she's there and all the men are like, oh my God, you know, around her. And so there was this idea that, you know, you were more attractive to men if you were a good shot. And so you see kind of...
To be fair, my wife is a very good shot, albeit with a longbow, and it was one of the first things that I noticed about her.
That is like, everyone always says to me, like, oh, women are such better shooters. And like, I think I missed that mark because I'm not a good shooter. That was a good pun that I didn't even intend to have. But yeah, so, you know, if you're a good shooter, then men are going to find you attractive and blah, blah, blah. And then they also, on top of that kind of woman target shooting kind of realm, they started showing off people like Annie Oakley, Lillian Smith, in advertisements. And then even in the 20th century, really famous female exhibition shooters, who were like amazing and could stand up against any man. I mean, Annie Oakley literally as a teenager beat a super famous marksman at a competition, who ended up becoming her husband. But, you know, he was like, oh, I'm going to go around and, you know, compete against these locals. And she ended up beating him at 16. So, these, you know, women are as respected as the men. And so they become basically sponsors, or like influencers, I guess, of the time frame. And so they're depicted in the ads as well. And not, you know, very clearly speaking to a female audience.
Well, thank you very much for that, Ashley. Do you feel better?
I don't know. I didn't think I was mad, but yeah, I was passionate, were. Right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. If you'd like to know more about this subject, then you can see Ashley on a range of documentaries. You can visit or check out at the Cody Firearms Museum that she used to be with at centreofthewest.org. And she does have her own podcast called History Unloaded. And you can find that wherever you find your podcast. We will have links to it in the show notes as well. Individually, you can follow Ashley on Twitter at Ashley Lubinsky or on Instagram at History in Heels. But once again, thank you very much for coming on here and definitely not firing blanks. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. We'd really appreciate any reviews you could leave for us with Apple, Podchaser, or Amazon. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I am at Paul Bavel.
And I am at Kyle G History.
And if you're loving this, then please support us on Patreon. In return for your cherished £5 per month, we will give you early episodes, entry into all of our prize book draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, from all of us here, stay angry. Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.